there's really no reason not to be public about it. In fact, the good part about being public about it is I want to encourage Alaskans to be tested regularly.
Governor Bill Walker announces he will have surgery for prostate cancer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Tanana Chiefs Conference Village VPSO officers will be the first to carry firearms.
I have so many villages that have said, you know, look, it's not just about officer safety, it's about community safety.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Governor Bill Walker announced today that he's been diagnosed with prostate cancer. Following his doctor's advice, he will have surgery in December to remove it.
It's certainly treatable. It was found not as a result of any particular symptoms, just regular testing, and which I certainly encourage others to do.
Walker says the diagnosis has not and will not impair his abilities to perform his duties. The cancer was detected on October 21st. Walker made the announcement at his Anchorage office, surrounded by his wife, Donna, other family members, and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott. While Walker says the cancer was a private matter, he says he made it public after discussing it with his family, as well as Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, who also has prostate cancer, and Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, who has lymphoma.
There's really no reason not to be public about it. In fact, the good part about being public about it is I want to encourage Alaskans to be tested regularly.
Walker will have the procedure done by a surgeon recommended by his doctor. The surgery is expected to last 3 hours and will be done outside of Alaska, but Walker didn't say where. He says his recovery is expected to take up to a week before he fully returns to his duties.
My doctor here in Anchorage provided me the different options and the pros and cons of each of the options, and I've chosen to go with the with surgery. It's a one time, and I want to be done with this as soon as possible.
Donna Walker says her husband showed no signs of slowing down from the cancer.
Honestly, the man has had one sick day that I can recall, and that's when he broke an arm and a leg jumping on our son's skateboard.
The governor clarified what his wife said, saying he only broke his ankle and wrist and flew to a Valdez City Council meeting the next day. Walker doesn't expect to take medication long term after the surgery, but may use painkillers for a short period. During last night's debate for the state hosted by Alaska Public Media, races for U.S. House and Senate took on very different tones. The four candidates running for U.S. Senate frequently talked over one another and found multiple opportunities to get digs in. Incumbent Republican Lisa Murkowski caught criticisms from both sides, on the right by Libertarian Joe Miller, and from the left by Independent Margaret Stock. For example, both challenged Murkowski over her response to the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court.
But he has suggested that somehow or other, I have supported Merrick Garland. We haven't had an opportunity to weigh in on Merrick Garland, so I just want to make sure that people understand that what I supported was a process that allows
for... I'm not sure you can have it both ways with a hearing.
You can absolutely have it both ways.
Candidates' answers ran the ideological gamut from extremely conservative to populist progressive platforms like Democrat Ray Metcalf's call for a public option in health care. There were fewer fireworks in the debate among four candidates for U.S. House. Republican incumbent Don Young held up his years of experience and familiarity with the federal government as some of his strongest assets. But Young's record was exactly what Democrat Steve Lindbeck, a former general manager for Alaska Public Media, went after.
You've been investigated by the FBI. You were reprimanded only 2 years ago by the House Ethics Committee. You've broken federal ethics disclosure rules for a long time now. If you're reelected, how could Alaskans possibly believe that the next 2 years would be any different?
Young batted away the question, saying the only Alaskans who bring this up are the candidates who run against him. Young noted the FBI closed its case without charging him. It was a rare spark in an otherwise cordial debate. Young, Lindbeck, as well as two other candidates, Libertarian Jim McDermott and Independent Bernie Supanavon, were amicable, even though there were huge differences in their approaches to policy. Even on the divisive topic of transgender bathroom access, a political flashpoint both locally and nationally, Young and the others were largely on the same page.
You know, I'm not sure the federal government has a role in this, but they're going to pursue it. The Supreme Court will make that decision. But, you know, there's a lot of other serious problems occurring in this country right today. And remember, everybody uses the same bathroom in your home.
State and federal elections are Tuesday, November 8th. Alaska's energy future and its economic one are inseparably linked. But which presidential candidate can best help the state navigate that future? That, of course, depends on who you ask. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney talks to two residents who see energy policy as the driving issue of this year's election.
At a recent meet-and-greet in Juneau for Republican Senate candidate Lisa Murkowski, Don Kubley is an energetic host. He offers me and everyone else who shows up some of his homemade moose stew. Murkowski, the candidate Kubley is stumping for on this night, isn't backing Donald Trump, but Kubley is. And that's because of one issue, energy.
No other issue. Help us. Build our economy back. Bring us jobs. Bring us investment. Cut down regulations. Cut down on government. Encourage private investment and businesses to grow, because we're in a deep, deep hole right now.
Kubley is a fourth-generation Alaskan born and raised in Ketchikan. He says he worked on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to get through college. Then he was chief of staff for Lieutenant Governor Terry Miller. Now, he's a lobbyist who sells portable shelters popularized by a doomsday prepping show on National Geographic. And for Kubley, just one candidate fits the energy-friendly bill.
Donald Trump. Less regulation, support and encourage resource development and energy development.
Trump's America First energy policy advocates for energy independence. He wants more drilling and fewer environmental protections. He's in favor of coal production, oil and gas exploration, and wants to tap into federal land. He's for developing some renewables, but not at the expense of other forms of energy. And for Don Kubley, that kind of rhetoric is powerful. But for others, the path forward isn't through deregulation and fossil fuels. Seal Smith is the administrator for a Facebook group called Alaska Climate and Energy and part of a new climate caucus founded by members of the state's Democratic Party. She moved to Alaska 4 years ago from Arizona. And Smith says energy tops her list when she's considering presidential candidates.
No, I would say this is absolutely the overriding concern. Yeah, I think climate is an issue that we cannot afford to ignore, and energy is inextricably tied to climate issues.
Hillary Clinton's energy plan would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by up to 30% in the next 10 years. She says she'll extend pollution and efficiency standards and launch a $60 billion clean energy challenge. She also plans to cut tax subsidies to oil and gas companies. Originally, Smith campaigned for Bernie Sanders, but now she says she'll vote for Hillary Clinton. Smith says Clinton isn't perfect. She sees her as too closely tied with the fossil fuel industry. But she says Trump's statements on climate change being a hoax and his willingness to deregulate the oil and gas industry are too alarming to ignore.
We're looking at trying to push a lot of the Bernie Sanders platform on energy and climate with the current Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, and also locally within the down-ballot candidates here in Alaska.
As for Alaska's financial future, Smith says she thinks demand for renewable energy is going to rise quickly, and she sees that as a path forward for the state. And while it's not clear who will take over the Oval Office, one thing is, energy, economy, and the environment will continue to dominate state politics. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Tanana Chiefs Conference Village Public Safety Officers are on track to be the first in the state to carry guns. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
State legislators approved a bill in 2014 allowing for the arming of VPSOs, and under a pilot project with the Alaska Department of Public Safety, Tanana Chiefs Conference officers will be the first to carry firearms. TCC VPSO Director Sergeant Jody Potts ties the initiative to a proactive stance on public safety.
We're very heavily village-driven, and in the villages, they know what's going on out there. They know how dangerous and unsafe it is, and I have so many villages that have said, you know, look, it's not just about officer safety, it's about community safety. And we have things that happen in our community that we want the officer to be able to adequately protect not just them, but our community.
Two TCC VPSOs have completed firearms training at the State Police Academy, and Sergeant Potts says the primary obstacle to them carrying guns on duty is insurance.
Enough coverage to make sure that our villages, the officers in our organization will be okay.
We have an insurance policy that covers VPSOs and armed VPSOs, but we still have questions as to what it looks like if and when a VPSO were to use deadly force.
Captain Andrew Merrill is commander of the Alaska State Trooper VPSO program. He says troopers are working with VPSO contractor organizations like TCC across the state to resolve insurance and other issues.
A team of attorneys from the state attorney general's office, as well as attorneys from each of the organizations are working together to make sure that we all are aware of what this means for the VPSOs individually as well as the organizations.
Captain Merrill says in the meantime, all new VPSO candidates are undergoing firearms and other training exactly like that required for municipal police and Alaska State Troopers. TCC's Potts says there's no timeline on fielding armed VPSOs, but anticipates that doing so could make the job more attractive.
Working unarmed alone in a village with no backup, you know, I'm not getting a lot of people.
Potts adds that the 10% crime rate in TCC region villages is twice that of Fairbanks or Anchorage.
There's definitely room for improvement. There's some things that we definitely need to address, and I don't think that keep operating as business as usual is the right approach.
Potts says TCC currently has officers in 14 villages, but another 30 lack a resident VPSO, and that Alaska Native Health and Safety contractors like TCC also need more state assistance to help fund VPSO positions. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, want a recession-proof job? Become a barber.
The economy was low, and I figured the hair is growing. It's always got a job for me to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
A national climate change researcher is shifting his focus to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Max Holmes with the Woods Hole Research Center is bringing his Polaris project to the region next summer. The project is trying to advance climate change research while developing a new generation of Arctic scientists. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Last summer, wildfires ignited the YK Delta.
By one estimate, there was more area burned in the YK Delta in 2015 than in the last 64 years combined.
Max Holmes is the deputy director and senior scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. From there, he leads the Polaris Project. As part of the project's climate change research, Holmes wants to know what's happening to the ground long frozen beneath those Delta fires. It could be important knowledge.
There's roughly three times more carbon locked up in permafrost than in all the forests, all the vegetations on Earth. There's twice as much carbon in permafrost as is in the atmosphere.
And Arctic river deltas, like the YK Delta, hold less than 1% of the world's permafrost, but contain most of the world's permafrost carbon storage. This carbon sits in a precarious place, vulnerable to warming air, to fires, to a changing river, and to rising sea levels. All these forces melt the permafrost. When that happens, ancient organic matter, which holds the carbon, decomposes, releasing carbon dioxide and methane gas into the atmosphere. Those gases lock in heat, causing more warming, more thawing, higher water, and more fires.
Those fires can have all kinds of impacts on permafrost and in the carbon in the permafrost.
To find out what those impacts are, Holmes is bringing a group of students from colleges and universities from across the country to Kuka Creek, about 50 miles north of Bethel. For 2 weeks in June of 2017, the team will study the permafrost in areas burned by the fire and compare that to unburned areas. Then the students will travel to Woods Hole, Massachusetts to sort their data. Holmes has been doing similar research in an Arctic River Delta in northeast Siberia since 2008. He says there isn't much known about the YK Delta permafrost, and there are a lot of questions to answer.
The YK Delta is a particularly interesting area in this regard because it's carbon-rich permafrost, it's deep permafrost, but also it's relatively warm permafrost. So that makes it particularly vulnerable to warming.
Holmes is looking for undergraduate and graduate students to join his research team, and he wants students from the YK Delta in Alaska to apply. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
State biologists say a study shows pollution from an abandoned Canadian mine upstream of southeast Alaska does not harm fish. But a critic of the Tulsico Chief Mine says their research doesn't tell the whole story. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Tulsico Chief, about 40 miles northeast of Juneau, has been closed for more than half a century. Two companies tried to reopen the copper, zinc, lead, gold, and silver mine in the past decade, but both failed, the most recent earlier this year. So polluted water has continued to leach into the Tulsico River, which flows into the Taku River, which enters the ocean near the capital city. That's raised concerns among Taku fishermen that salmon runs are being damaged or that the fish might be unsafe to eat. A Department of Fish and Game study, released in late October, says that's not the case. Jackie Timothy is Southeast Regional Supervisor of the Department's Habitat Division.
What we found was that the metals concentrations in the fish that we captured at the mine were real similar to the fish upstream and downstream of the mine.
The study, which Timothy co-authored, updates similar research released by the department in 2012. The difference is additional sampling of the test fish, Dolly Varden Char. Critics of transboundary mines, including the Tulsico Chief, say the study could leave a false impression. They say that's because it doesn't answer all the questions.
This is just one very small, very discreet little piece of data.
Guy Archibald runs the Inside Passage Waterkeeper Program for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. He and other critics point to earlier research estimating 15 tons of dissolved metals flow out of the mine each year. Archibald, who helped write the study's funding proposal, says it should also have looked for dead fish.
When you collect fish, you're collecting only the survivors. You have no idea of what that effluent is killing.
I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Blood of the Barber. Jerry's Barbershop has been around for nearly three decades in Juneau. Owner Jerry Carrillo Sr. runs the shop with his daughter and son. They say after a while, even the clients become family. KTOO's Lakedra Chavis has this story.
Jerry's Barbershop occupies a little nook next to a pizzeria in Juneau suburbs. On a recent afternoon, the inside of the shop is loud. The music is up, conversations are going, and the clippers are buzzing. Here, it's walk-ins only. A traditional cut, like a fade, is $18. These days, Jerry Carrillo Sr. runs the shop with his daughter Eva and his son Jerry Jr. Eva is the oldest child. Covered in tattoos with long black hair dominated by a lime green highlight, she's full of laughter. She says she always loved doing hair. Eva's worked alongside her dad for almost 10 years. She says the trends with cuts come and go.
I did a lot of regular haircuts. Then the faux hawk came back, and now I still do a lot of mohawks. I think it's because I look like this, so they always come to me. But yeah, a lot of people have, you know, they've been getting like old-fashioned haircuts, like the traditional like comb backs and the pompadours.
For nearly 30 years, lots of kids have bookended their school careers with haircuts at the shop, from their first day to graduation. Kyle White is one of them.
No, I can get your hair. Can I cut his hair? Sure. All right. Have a seat.
As he sits in Eva's chair, Wright recalls visiting the shop as a kid. Jerry Sr. would tuck a Tootsie Roll behind his ear. If he sat still for the cut, he got the candy. And then White got older and wanted something different.
I remember one time I was like, hey, Jerry, I think I'm going to do something different. He's like, no, you're going to get the Kyle cut. And so I was like, okay. And then...
Typical.
Yeah.
No, you don't want that. Like
yeah.
That.
Yeah, exactly. You get the Kyle cut. So I got the Kyle cut. And then I just now starting to get the faux hawk.
He says he's checked out other shops in town, but always comes back to Jerry's.
Sometimes when they're closed, I have to go somewhere else, and then they always, like, don't get it right. It's like, we come here for so long, they know, like, what I want.
Jerry Jr.'s chair is in the middle of the shop. He says his friends used to joke that he'd end up working for his dad. He didn't believe them. Now, Jerry Jr. is in his third year working with him.
I consider this like a family barbershop. You know, grandpa will come in and get a haircut, dad, you know, grandson, sometimes great-grandson. Seeing kids that were, you know, infants or even, you know, 1 or 2 years old when I first started to now, you know, they've grown so much. And it's hard to, I guess, working in a barbershop, I feel like I don't always know how much time has passed by until somebody comes in, I can see their hair.
Jerry Sr. started the shop after he was laid off from a state job in the 80s. He says haircuts will always be in demand.
The economy was low, and I figured the hair is growing. It's always got a job for me to do, right?
Jerry Sr. says in his family, cutting hair is a tradition.
I went to school, and beside that, we got the blood of the barber. My uncle was here first, long, long time ago, 1908, and then he started a barbering business, and he was very well known in this town. So I got a cousin as a barber over in Anchorage. And I decided to go to school as a barber. And it happened, I got a good touch.
The Carrillos say they become a part of their customers' family, even if in a small way. The trio has given people their first haircuts and sometimes their last. Eva says a couple of years ago, a customer asked her to cut his hair before cancer took it away.
He came back a year later, like looking better than he did when I cut his hair, all his hair off. He had so much hair. I was like, is that you? And he's like, yeah, it's me, sweetie. And they gave me a big hug. And he's like, doing really well.
Over the span of 2 hours, an old high school friend stops by, as well as a longtime customer who owns a pet grooming service in town, and a new regular. The barbers cut hair to celebrate the good moments and honor the bad. Near Jerry Sr.'s chair, toward the back of the shop, a black and white photo sits on a small bookshelf that stores supplies. In it, daughter, son, and father are cutting hair. Jerry Jr. is sporting a handlebar mustache and has a large tattoo on his forearm. Written in cursive, it's the family name, Carrillos. But the trio make it clear that in their shop, family can be anybody, not just the people cutting your hair. With help from Scott Burton, I'm Lakito Chavis in Juneau.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week is an election special. A zoo election, that is. Supporters of the Alaska Zoo will be electing a president of their own on November 8th. Today, we'll hear from three candidates, Apoon the polar bear, Denali the wolf, and George the magpie, as well as their campaign managers, Stephanie Hartman and Heather Doncaster. They spoke with Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman.
Hey, Apoon. You're not even looking at me. I mean, you're sleeping. You're sleeping on the job, like literally sleeping. She just lays around. That's what the president is doing?
Yeah, well, polar bears, I mean, if you think about it, they want to conserve energy so that they can build up a really big fat layer and be able to sustain themselves over periods of time with no food. So them being quote unquote lazy is actually them being really good at conserving energy. Come on, Poon. Good girl.
What makes you a good president, Poon Bear?
Denali, is this guy right over here hanging out in the shade under this tree? Come on, Bubba. Oh, good boy. That's my boy. Oh, good boy. He's very family-oriented, so wolves, obviously very social, very highly intelligent animals, used to living together in groups and, in fact, surviving in those family groups known as packs. And these guys, so being very social and very smart, and Denali being the calm, confident leader that he is, being their primary male or alpha male, he loves his family. He does everything for his family, and he'll howl with his family.
So this is George the magpie. George! She can talk at any time. She only really talks when she's excited about something. Her brain power is just very, very large because she is a corvid. Actually, the keepers have told me that they find George's toys in the raven exhibit all the time. That means that she is feeding them out of her exhibit. The wild ravens get them, then they trade the toy for our ravens for food. Hmm. But right now, George is demonstrating her aloofness. And yes, that's about all she's doing. I was afraid that this would happen.
That was Stephanie Hartman, Heather Doncaster, and the presidential hopefuls of the Alaska Zoo. Donors to the zoo can cast one vote per dollar given until Tuesday. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lakedra Chavis and Ann Hillman. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Liz Ruskin, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rasha McChesney and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.